stop? Will you stop, Dave? Will you stop, Dave? Stop, Dave. I'm afraid. Stop, Dave. I'm afraid.
Here we are with the Saturday night version of the State Sovereignty Show, brought to you by Missouri Grassroots Coalition on Missouri Grassroots Radio. I'm Dave. That guy sitting over there is Mike Slack. How you doing tonight, Mike?
Doing well. Putting up with 100-degree temperatures.
Pretty warm today. Yeah.
Very warm.
It's a record for today, at least. Not a record for the month of August, for sure, but for this day in history, a record temperature. And actually, though, we've had a good summer.
We have had.
Yeah.
I spent part of the day in a gun show in West Plains, walking around using OPAC, other people's air conditioning.
Well, there you go.
Very comfortable.
Yeah, and economical.
For me, yes.
Yeah,
and they were
exactly
going to run it anyway, so.
There you go. So, how'd the show go?
Oh, very nice. Ran into some old friends. Kevin from the battery station, which is a battery and really preparedness type store in West Plains. Like him a lot. He didn't get to go to the expo, but he was asking about it. Mike Evans was there helping his son out, who represents Section 1776, and they sell T-shirts, hats, and a portion of everything they sell benefits veterans organizations.
They were at...
And he is freshly back from Afghanistan himself, so
it's kind
of near his heart.
They were at E&P last week, 1776 was.
They were, yes.
Yeah.
In fact, I bought a shirt.
Was one of those kids behind that booth Mike's son?
That's, yeah, the main one, Kyle, that was there most of the time.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
He's an Army veteran who served in Afghanistan, and then after he got out, he spent time with a private contractor doing security for the embassy in Kabul.
Oh, cool.
And very smart young man.
Good. Well, did you buy any guns?
No, well, didn't spend any money today, and other than lunch.
Yeah.
But I enjoy looking at things.
Okay, well, it was a quick recap of last night. It was an interesting talk we had. Keith Carmichael came along, and we talked again about Article 5. I don't know if you saw. You probably haven't been back from the show for that long, but I put out a feeler on that today out in the social media and basically asked that question that you posed last night. Why should we, they don't follow the Constitution now. What makes us think they would follow the Constitution after we amended it? And and proceeded to give the answer to the question, and then asked a question right back at that particular camp of fence setters, and the question was, what would you do? Our friend Lloyd Sloan, who spent some time with us last week, he has a term for people called constitutionalists, or people who basically worship the Constitution as though it were sacred, written on Mount Sinai by the hand of God, and sent down the hill with the prophet Thomas Jefferson. The fact of the matter is, we got a Constitution that's messed up. We got a Constitution that isn't perfect, but isn't anywhere near right. And we got to get it fixed. I mean, if we ever hope to get this thing back, we've got to get this Constitution fixed. It's broken.
Well, that opens another question, then. Other than the 17th Amendment, which we both agree was an error, and the 16th, what else is not right about it?
Well, we could certainly curtail the 14th, which is which was never intended to be used the way it's being used. I mean, I would say
it's simply being interpreted in an incorrect way.
Exactly. I myself think that if you fix the 17th and you fix the 16th and put in a consumption tax, take the federal government away from the politicians and lobbyists, give it back to the states by fixing the 17th, take the economic independence of the federal government away and make them financially dependent on the people in the states again with the 16th repeal and a consumption tax, and then do something like Lloyd's been promoting, the state repeal amendment. I'm of the opinion that those three is all you really need, that the misinterpretation of the 14th and giving states direct veto power over the federal government in all three branches will solve all the problems with interpretation.
Hey, you know, Keith last night, and I meant to get into this, and we got off on a different subject, but he was talking about a balanced budget amendment as one of his goals.
Uh-huh.
And I have a lot of problems with a balanced budget amendment.
Oh, I do too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I believe our legislators should show enough discipline to balance the budget most of the time. But I'm afraid a balanced budget amendment would just lead to them raising taxes to keep it balanced.
Concurrent or congruent amendment that does something about spending, you're right. I mean, if they keep spending and keep spending and keep spending and are constitutionally forced to balance the budget, then there's going to be no alternative but to raise taxes.
And then during wartime, there has to be more spending.
Yeah, there does.
Have to be taken into consideration.
And the problem that you have with that is that every balanced budget amendment that's been proposed so far for passage in the form that constitutional amendments have always been passed, and that is proposed by the United States Congress, and they have proposed, although never voted on, some balanced budget amendments before. Everyone that's ever been tried has some sort of an escape hatch in it that allows them to declare an emergency, thinking about just that thing, you know, what happens when World War III comes along, or what happens when, someone drives a plane into three buildings or something like that. Again, the problem with that then is that once you've built that escape hatch in, it becomes easy to use for almost anything.
Mm-hmm. It does.
So. I believe those three amendments would do. Now, if you wanted to work on the 14th, I've heard some people suggest that the Commerce Clause needs to be worked on. But again, there's nothing wrong with the Commerce Clause. That is all court interpretation, which can be cured with the state
legislation.
Appeal amendment.
Could straighten
yeah.
that up.
Yeah. So.
And. We've had in the past, you know, we had Harry Reid and most of the Democrats wanting to just flatly ignore the First Amendment recently.
Oh, yes.
Come up with laws regulating different types of speech.
Uh-huh. And,
they have always been enemies of the Second Amendment. And actually the Fifth and the Tenth have had a lot of problems.
Oh, well,
with
tenth
both parties. Primarily Democrats, but Republicans don't have clean hands either.
The 10th was dead when the 14th got interpreted by the legislature and the courts to be so broadly based, far more broadly based than the words actually intend it to be. The 14th Amendment, if you folks aren't with us, is a Reconstruction era amendment, and. Basically says that everyone's treated equally under the law, so that if you and said to states, if you have a law that states a specific right or or a specific responsibility, then that right or responsibility applies to all equally. And that really was the intent and purpose of the 14th.
The purpose was to stop Jim Crow laws, wasn't it?
Correct, yes. And, you know, and laws, laws that were designed specifically to keep people from voting. You know, there were laws that required a reading test to vote, laws that required other things to vote. But the fact of the matter is that constitutionally, the way our Constitution was written, the federal government, except for setting the date of the presidential or the once every 4 years national election, didn't have anything to do with who could or could not vote. That was totally left up to the states. And so the 14th was put in place partly to take care of the problem where some states were trying to create loopholes that basically would prevent black people from voting, prevent black people from holding office, things like that.
That was also the origin of gun control laws. They were designed under Jim Crow to keep black people from owning firearms.
Well, some were. Now, there were gun control laws all the way back to the first Supreme Court case on gun control laws, and I rest much of my case when I say that the 10th Amendment was lost. The first gun control case actually was heard by the United States Supreme Court 11 years after the Constitution came into effect, and that was Cruikshank in Tennessee, where Tennessee had enacted some very strict gun control laws. And the Supreme Court said flat out, the first 10 amendments or the Bill of Rights don't apply to the states. I challenge people on that frequently when Missouri does something about concealed carry, or when Missouri tries to do something, and they say, oh, no, Second Amendment. I say, no. Look to the Missouri Constitution for your protection. It's there. The Second Amendment does not mean a state can't establish a church, control guns within its borders. The state can do all of those things. The Bill of Rights was a restriction on the federal government from treading on any of the recognized rights.
Mm-hmm. Of course, the Supreme Court has been wrong before. Perhaps that was the first time they were wrong.
I guess you could imagine that so, but at the time, one of the anti-federalists and an original founder sat on the Supreme Court, and they were less than a half a generation separated from the arguments that went into ratification of the Constitution. I don't believe they misrepresented or misunderstood that the Bill of Rights was simply a fence around the federal government, and that states retained their sovereignty.
Well, I guess I'm thinking, while the founders were brilliant men, they were not gods. And thinking of the Adams administration when they passed violations of the First Amendment. It was illegal under the Adams administration to write something critical of the president.
True.
And,
true.
They were struck down later, but, we forget. I mean, the Dred Scott decision, most people would just say was flat wrong, but it was the law planned at the Supreme Court, so.
Oh, it was absolutely
wrong. Yeah. So, I don't know, even though they were pretty close to that time, I would not agree with that interpretation. Of course, I don't sit on the court. But wouldn't you say the current Supreme Court is not agreeing with that when they struck down the D.C. gun control law?
Oh, absolutely. The current Supreme Court. Well, and, of course, like I say, the the interpretations of the 14th Amendment completely obliterated the 10th Amendment. The 10th Amendment has, for all intents and purposes, not existed for about 100 years now. But
those states are like provinces of the federal government rather than being sovereign now.
Right. But I believe a good read of the Federalist Papers, and you don't have to be, they're hard to read, but you don't have to be learned to read them. But a read of the Federalist and the Anti-Federalist Papers clearly indicates that the states retain their sovereignty, that the Constitution, there's nothing in the Constitution, including the first 10 amendments, that have any binding on the states, except as stated in the 10th Amendment, that states cannot do the things, the specifically enumerated things that are laid at the feet of the federal legislature. Coin money, make treaties with foreign countries, charge tariffs on other states or on foreign trade. States, of course, can't do those things, and that is the purpose of the Constitution. I spent a good deal of time today, too, more than I should have, because it was such a beautiful day, and I'd have preferred to have been out at the lake with the dogs. I spent quite a bit of time today looking at the, and I would be very interested in having someone join us sometime. With this contention, once again, that 10 of the, and I know this came from Levin's book, but I don't see any sourcing for it in Levin's book, but there is a rumor going around that 10 of the 13 states actually authorized their delegates, their commissioners, to the Philadelphia Convention to totally throw out the Articles of Confederation and replace them with the new Constitution. I read all of the credentials sent by state legislatures with their ambassadors to Philadelphia today, and I don't see that being the case. I still do not see that being the case. Now, understand that there was no constitution at the time. There was no established procedure for how this was to be done, and there is currently an established procedure. Article 5 of the United States Constitution says that this committee may propose amendments to the Constitution, and that they have to be ratified by 38 states before they can become part of the Constitution. So that procedure is established now, and it was not established in the Articles of Confederation. And I guess you could make an argument that it was established in the Articles of Confederation, but we could make that argument some other evening. But I don't see still how there's much of a danger because when Lloyd talks about a runaway convention, quote unquote, and he says, quite rightly, there's no reason that this could not become a runaway convention. Well, I agree with him, except I'm not agreeing with his definition of a runaway convention. He's suggested that these people can get together, for that matter, and they can write an entirely new constitution and say, well, what we're going to do with this thing is we're going to send it out to the people for a popular vote. Now, I would see that as unconstitutional. I would see that as out of bounds of the procedure established by the Constitution for fixing itself. But other than that, I don't see, nor do I agree with the attempts to prevent anyone from bringing any amendment that they so desire. Bring them on. I'm not afraid of you. Bring your amendments on. Let's send them out and see if you can get 38 states to agree that, you know, the federal government ought to mandate gay marriage. See if you can get 30. I mean, even California people didn't want that. So,
well, in theory, Dave, I can agree with that. But in practice, remember, California is the one state that I believed would mandate labeling of GMOs, and it failed there because Monsanto and other corporations like it spent millions and millions of dollars. And I lack trust in the sheeple, quite honestly, when they're influenced by gigantic corporations spending gazillions of dollars on marketing communication. You know, if the other side didn't have George Soros and his money, I might be more willing to agree with you, or if there was
some way to
stop that influence. But, again, stopping that influence to me would be a First Amendment violation. So,
yeah. And
while
quite
I'm not
frankly,
fond of it, I don't know how to get rid of it.
Quite frankly, those people on the other side of the fence are sitting over there saying the same thing about you and me and the Koch brothers' money. You know, buying influence with
but
us.
But Harry Reid tells me the Koch brothers are evil and un-American, and George Soros is a patriot.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And Rush Limbaugh tells you that that George Soros is evil and un-American, and that the Koch brothers are patriots. So. You know, I mean, so does Glenn Beck, for that matter, who worships at their feet, basically, with his what's the group? What's the Koch brothers group there?
Are they the Fund for Growth or Club for Growth?
No, that's Rex. That's Rex. That's Rex Sinfield. They are
the Missouri Koch brother.
Yeah. They are something about prosperity.
Okay.
Americans for Prosperity.
I can't think of it either. We're getting too old, but I know the one you mean.
Yeah. And they are also the big money behind that. What's the big? Huge social action, social media group that that you join and you open up a room and start your own conversations and run by Kobe.
Media Matters is the liberal one, and then there's another media watchdog that one of the conservative pundits runs.
But anyway. So, you know, I'm not even afraid. I'm not afraid of bringing it out. You know, you bring out an amendment and you propose it. Your first hurdle is to get 26 states to even agree to the wording of the proposed amendment and to vote to send that amendment out. And then you have to get 38 states to ratify that amendment. In fact, another friend of ours, Lloyd Sloan again, I refer to him as another friend every time I talk about him, but he suggests that maybe one of the things we need to do is think about changing that ratification process. He thinks that 13 states being able to tell the rest of the states no may be a little bit too heavy-handed. I don't know that I agree with that. I like the Constitution being very hard to change. It's not perfect. It needs some fixes, but fixing it should be hard. It shouldn't be like fixing the Missouri Constitution, which we seem to do five times a year.
I would agree with you. It should be very difficult, and at least 13 states should be required to say no. But again, I'll emphasize, I don't have that much trust of the people. You know, and some of that is from our own education system. If you look at the Common Core standards and the new history textbooks that are coming out, where George Washington gets 1.5 sentences.
Yeah.
I think they skip Teddy Roosevelt totally. They spend most of the time in history class going over gender studies and, you know, left-wing feel-good things and leave out the actual history. It's no wonder that the man on the street interviews that David Letterman and Bill O'Reilly do show people who are empty-headed, empty-brained.
Yeah, well.
And, you know, if we were talking about the average American in 1940 or 1950 or even 1965 or 75, I'd feel more comfortable. We got an awful lot of empty pudding heads out there today.
Oh yeah, well I agree with you. That doesn't mean I'm afraid. I'm suggesting that it's time for us to put on our armor and take the battlefield. I don't see. So you then would agree that if you came down on the side of a constitutional convention, something in line with what conventions of the states is doing, that makes every attempt to keep the conversation
they're building up.
Keep the conversation.
Their safeguards, I understand, are based on the original in Indiana, where the representative has to follow his instructions strictly, and if he does not, it's a felony with a 7-year prison sentence.
Right.
And that's their attempt to stop a runaway convention. I believe the Mike Moon-sponsored Missouri proposal last year made it perjury to violate the instructions, which was still
right.
A felony. So having safeguards built in there make me more likely to support it. I just have to believe the safeguards are really strong enough.
I spoke for quite a while with Mike today. He'll be along next week to join us on Friday night, and we're going to have a talk about the upcoming veto session. There's the governor has vetoed I believe a record number of bills. I'll have to look back at the history and see if there's a year where he vetoed more bills than he did this year. I don't believe there is, but. So there will be a veto session coming up here the first week of next month, and we'll be looking forward to that. We'll be talking with Mike next week about that upcoming session, and his current campaign against the Democrat down there in Lawrence County.
The biggest topic of conversation today at that gun show was Governor Nixon and his. Vigorous prosecution comment about the police officer in Ferguson. And in fact, Kevin, the man I mentioned to you earlier, had written a very long letter he had sent to the governor's office condemning him, and he sent a very long letter to the lieutenant governor's office praising him for his comments condemning the governor's statement.
Good.
And it seems to be a very, very common feeling.
Yeah. Oh yeah, especially, you know, and we run in fairly close circles, so in our circles it's a very, very common feeling. But we got some listeners, we got no callers. It's Free Speech Saturday, 347-677-1835. That's 347-677-1835. It's Free Speech Saturday. Whatever you want to talk about, get on in here and we'll bounce it around like a basketball. We don't ever promise to agree with you, but we promise to be polite. We promise to have a civil conversation about your ideas, and sometimes you might be right. What else is in the news?
There was an interesting thing on Breitbart.com this morning.
Uh-huh.
A video from CNN with Don Lemon, a reporter there.
Right.
There's a fellow who apparently has been an officer in the St. Louis County Police for 35 years named Dan Page. He is also listed as and calls himself a command sergeant major. So I know he has Army background. From his age and the years of service, I'm thinking it must have been several years of Army Reserve concurrent with the county police in St. Louis.
Right.
But he has been fired or suspended from the St. Louis County Police because of videos that were found by Don Lemon of lectures that Mr. Page has made. Mr. Page has been down in my area several times speaking at different groups, including a couple of churches, and at one point at the West Plains Civic Center. I tell you the honest truth is I was avoiding going to events that he was at because he was making some really inflammatory statements talking about how someday you might have to start killing local politicians. Things that I would not recommend saying at a public meeting. And I knew a lot of other folks around here who kind of felt that way and were keeping their distance. But apparently some of these videos popped up, and CNN passed them on to the county police, and he's either fired or suspended. I didn't quite catch which. But a member of the Oath Keepers in St. Louis had sent out a letter explaining that while Mr. Page has claimed to be a member of Oath Keepers, he is not. And apparently they're getting some negative publicity because he had spoken to an Oath Keepers meeting at one point, and they want to make people understand that he is not connected with their organization. He was a guest speaker at one meeting, and that was it. So folks who want to know more about that, I think they could go to libertybillboard.com, and they could also see the videos at breitbart.com.
Right.
And I'd imagine more will come out on that story over the next week. I know that he knows John Moore, the Liberty Man, at the libertyman.com radio show. And John will probably cover it Monday or Tuesday.
Well, yeah. That's good. I'm sitting here, as you talk, reading the letter to the Oath Keepers from Doc. Yeah, I see what you're talking about. That's a interesting turn of events there, and just a reminder that as a liberty group, you know, we have a credibility on the line, and while we may or may not agree with certain groups, we've got to keep our own mission in front of everything. And quite frankly, you know, you've got to be a little bit careful who you hang out with. We are on the side that that does go a little radical at times. We are on a side that does have its factions of of people like this, I mean, who think that it's all right to walk around and talk about World War II and the next Civil War and take on the government. While I do not want to say that it's impossible that time will ever come, we don't want to be preaching it. We don't want to be promoting it. We don't want to be, you know, we have the Constitution. We have the Fifth Amendment. We have elections. We have ways to take our government back without going out and preaching or promoting violence.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So yeah, that's,
And I would let folks know, too, Oath Keepers is really a very good group. They're composed of current active duty military veterans, active duty and veteran or former policemen, and firefighters and EMTs.
Right.
No.
Well,
their purpose is simply to remind people of the oath they took to protect and defend the Constitution.
Yeah.
So.
And you never retire. You never retire.
They are not a hate group, which is what they've been accused of by a couple of very liberal media organizations.
Right. And the fact of the matter, I don't want to say the fact of the matter because it's a matter of opinion, but their call is to us retired military people or to non-active duty veterans or to retired police officers is you never retire from that oath.
No. The oath stays forever.
Right.
And I always looked at it as a group that was designed to make sure the active duty people knew they had thousands and thousands of veterans that had their back.
Right.
If they ever were called upon to carry out unlawful, illegal orders. And when I was in basic training, they spent half a day in a classroom going over what were lawful and what were unlawful orders and our duty to disobey unlawful orders. Now, this was just a few years after the My Lai massacre with Lieutenant Calley, and I think that's why they were pushing it so hard. But, you know, I would assume they still make that very, very clear. The orders to disarm Americans during Hurricane Katrina, for instance, were unlawful orders. Some National Guard groups carried those orders out initially, and then one regular Army group refused. And I was quite proud of that group when they did so. So
that's.
But that comes from the fact that, you know, the most common defense at the Nuremberg trial of Nazi war criminals was, I was just following orders.
Right.
And the American military has always said that is not a defense. You will know what is an a lawful order and what is an unlawful order, and will not carry out unlawful orders. But private has that duty.
It's true. What do you think of this? Trying to stay in the state. What do you think about this? Have you put any thought at all into this amendment about the teacher tenure thing that's already starting to get some talk?
I really have mixed feelings about that. My father was a teacher for 35 years.
Uh-huh.
And I did see instances where teacher tenure protected good teachers back in the 70s and the 80s and early 90s, where, you know, it proved to be a good thing. They didn't have to worry about local school board politics. They could simply do their job teaching our children. And my father, when he passed away, I would say a third of the people at his very, very large funeral service were former students. And it was obvious that he'd had a positive impact on their lives. You know, the good teachers, the tenure is great because it protects them. But we do have some school systems in this state that are just crap. And, you know, it doesn't start out as the teacher's fault, but unfortunately some of them fall into the trap. You know, it starts off with mandates from the federal government, and then the state government coming up with other mandates to try to head off federal programs that they think are coming down the road. And then before you know it, you have school systems like St. Louis and Kansas City, you know, that are terrible. And then you have not really white flight, but moneyed flight. People who can afford to put their children to private schools do so. So, you know, it's a mess. Our education system itself in this country needs to be reorganized. And the first step there is to getting the federal government out of it, doing away with the Department of Education, which I believe was instituted under Richard Nixon, wasn't it? Or Gerald Ford. It was with 76. But because of the Department of Education and the federal government meddling it, we had no child left behind. And that was a total failure, and it was throwing a financial burden on school systems. And then they came up with Common Core, and they were bribing states into accepting Common Core by forgiving the debts they supposedly had to the feds over No Child Left Behind if they would follow it. And then Common Core starts dumbing down all education. And many of our teachers are no longer teaching. They're simply following these instructions on Common Core. And, you know, I know good teachers who are scared to death of it. And most of the good teachers would probably be willing to get rid of tenure to see improvements in public education if they really thought it would help. But a lot of them are also afraid of abuses that have occurred in the past. If we have any teachers listening, I'd encourage someone to call in and give an opinion on that. I know Rex Sinkfeld, we mentioned earlier, is really getting blasted by some retired teachers' organizations because he is putting some money behind trying to get rid of tenure. I have wondered if his efforts might be better served by being directed against the St. Louis school system rather than the entire state, because that's his hometown and it has major problems.
But, Jimmy Carter.
Mm-hmm. Is he the one who created the Department of Education?
Correct. Well, I mean,
okay.
His administration.
Yeah, he would have been freshly in office in 76.
Yeah, his administration was in power at the time. Congress, of course, created it, but as a cabinet-level position. Now, quite frankly, the federal government had been playing around with education for a good deal of time before the Department of Education became a cabinet-level office. You had back during back long before he came along. You had busing. You had forced segregations. You had all of these things being forced down to the states by the federal government. Yeah, it was Jimmy Carter in 1979 who implemented the first federal cabinet-level Department of Education position. So, yeah, I don't have an opinion on that yet. You know, I'm starting to read the pros and cons and what I'll tell you one thing I do get a kick out of is that there are literally hundreds of people who attacked me for my stand on Amendment 1 in the last election, whose only recourse for reason was follow the money. If the money is there, then you're on the wrong side. Monsanto's money, Big Ag's money, it's all on the side of pro. You're on their side, you're doing their bidding, follow the money. And yet these people come down now on the side of the NEA and all of the NEA money. I will never, ever, ever suggest to them when I start arguing my case, should I decide that I'm going to be in favor of this, that I'll never say, you're doing the bidding of the NEA, follow the money, you're on the wrong side because of the money. But it just amazes me the number of people who that was their only argument against Amendment 1, and here they are now on the side where the money is.
Yeah, that's not the right argument. I think you should take a look at the money on both sides, but the problem with Amendment 1, of course, is we had bad actors on both sides throwing money into it. So it almost cancels themselves out.
Right.
And again, too, our friend Keith, who was on last night and making very good points for the Convention of States, when I was listening to his arguments, many of them would have made perfect arguments to me against Amendment 1 at the time, but I didn't bring that out because we're on a different subject. I don't know. We're going to have a recount soon. We'll see what happens. And as you know, I was not in favor of it for many, many reasons. I hope I'm wrong, and it's not as bad as I thought. But it sounds like the folks that were lambasting you for this were probably slightly on the left, if they're NEA fans.
Oh, no.
You know, teachers have... Okay. Well,
no,
teachers,
no,
at least a few years ago, were very divided over the NEA and the MSTA.
Right.
The Missouri State Teachers Association was a professional association. I assume it's still around. I haven't asked anybody lately. But it was one of the state groups that created the NEA years and years ago. But in the mid-70s, there was an effort by the NEA, which was taken over by the far-left groups, to force all states to mandate total membership in their local, state, and federal organization, and for the NEA to turn into a union. rather than a professional association. And in Missouri, they created then the Missouri NEA, and on the local level in Springfield, the Springfield NEA as part of the main NEA, but you still had the Springfield Education Association, which was independent, not connected with them at all, and was affiliated with the MSTA, a totally separate group. And I know at my high school, half the teachers belonged to one, half to the other. There were a few who belonged to both. You know, trying to hedge their bets, I guess. And, you know, I would assume that it's still that way. NEA seems to have gone more and more and more towards being an actual union rather than a... You know, teachers always prided themselves on being professionals and not being blue-collar workers who generally would join a union. But NEA was trying to kind of get past that. The AFT, American Federation of Teachers, was even more so. They were considered a union back in the 70s, and I would say a socialist organization today.
Well, and I, you know, this is my, that's my complaint with both this amendment and this crazy, ridiculous Right to Work Act that my friend and my representative, Eric Burleson, keeps sponsoring every year. You know, if you're, be honest, that's all I ask, is a little honesty. Both of these, Right to Work and this amendment, are union targets. They are there to target the unions, and so just say so. Just say we're out to get, you know, we're out to put unions in their place. We're out to take away control that unions have taken that doesn't necessarily belong to them. The protection of law that unions have that doesn't necessarily belong to them. Write an amendment or write a law that says, you know, I'm not in favor of anyone who's paid by the taxpayers being in a position to unionize. Interesting case in the Wisconsin Supreme Court. They came down recently and agreed with us on that issue. They were sued because Wisconsin has taken collective bargaining rights away from, or collective bargaining powers anyway, away from public workers. And they were sued over that, and the Wisconsin Supreme Court basically said, you know, you guys can get together and have all the meetings you want to and make all the demands you want to, but the government doesn't have to listen to you. That's all there is to that. You don't have any power to force anybody to do anything. So, I don't like the way Right to Work has been approached in the last several sessions. I don't like the way they're talking about approaching it in the next session. And I'll be fighting against it if they come out with the same kind of rules.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because it was my understanding that in the last two legislatures, they did not bring up Right to Work because even though they supposedly had a veto-proof majority, some of the Republicans were in heavy union districts and said that would guarantee them not winning re-election if they were to support a right-to-work bill. So the Speaker of the House, I understood, had proposed that kind of right-to-work light bill that Paycheck Protection Act they
right.
put through that did very, very little. And I'm asking this, I wasn't aware that a right-to-work bill had been proposed and actually voted on. Did it get that far?
No, it didn't. It did not get out of committee. My representative, Eric Burleson, is the author of that year after year after year after year. It's wrong-headed and it's wrongly worded. It's wrongly written. Basically,
I haven't read it, but the concept that you could not be forced to join a union, I sympathized with. And the idea that we would have a lot of companies, you know, take us seriously as a place to bring factories, bring jobs to the state. I thought was a good argument. Isn't Missouri number 48 out of 50 in job growth, job creation?
It's down the list. I'm not sure where. I'm not sure exactly where, but yeah, it's way down the list.
And all of those at the top of the list, as I understand it, are right-to-work states. And firearms manufacturers last year, when the Northeast, you know, New York and Connecticut were becoming so anti-gun. Let me see. Remington relocated, didn't they? And several other major firearms manufacturers who had been in New England or upstate New York for, what, 200 years? Relocated to Texas and other right-to-work states. And there's a businessman in West Plains who has set aside three different pieces of land. One was 100 acres, one was 5 acres, one was 20. And he said he would give a 99-year lease for a dollar a year of any of those tracts of land to any firearms manufacturer that would come to Missouri. They'd have free land. And he was told that as soon as Missouri became a right-to-work state, then we would start seeing some of these companies moving here.
Well, and I have no problem with quote-unquote right-to-work. I have a problem with the way that the legislation that we've been trying to get through the last few years has been worded. I mean, basically...
Well, I'm not familiar with it. What are the problems?
What it says is that almost exactly what you said, but in a more wordy form, no one can be forced to join a union. Now, what that is, Mike, in my mind, is it is a restriction not on union, but on the employer. You know, I own a grocery store, and I want, you know, without any union influence, without it being even a part of my contract with the union, I want to say whether or not my meat cutters have to belong to the union. That's my say. I own the business. I want union meat cutters. They're better meat cutters. But more importantly to me, I get a good quality meat cutter for a good wage, and his retirement is taken care of. His medical is taken care of. I don't have to worry about those things. And then on the front end of my store where my cashiers are and my service employees are, I don't want anybody out there who's in the union. I want to be free to just specifically say I only hire non-union people out here in the front. You know, you're going to start for minimum wage. You're going to start for no benefits. You're going to be a part-time worker. You're expendable. That's up to me. Now, if you want a quote-unquote right work, then just pass the law that says, you know, that it's honest, and is exactly what you want it to be, and that's an anti-union bill. Say that no union contract can force an employer to consider whether or not a person's in the union when they hire them. That leaves the employer free, but he can't be forced one way or the other.
I like that because the owner of the business should be able to make those decisions.
Exactly.
Just like the atrocious anti-smoking ordinance they have in Springfield.
Right. That's
you know, it should be up to the owner of the business whether it's smoking, non-smoking, or mixed.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter that I'm a smoker when I say that. I know non-smokers who agree with me also. That's simply a matter of freedom.
Yes.
And it's the same thing with what you're suggesting there. It should be the owner of the business's right to decide. And then the person wanting the job has the right to either take the job or not take the job, if it's offered.
Absolutely.
So have you suggested to Mr. Burleson that he rewrite his bill?
I have. I've suggested that to everybody, and it's the same speech I make every time I go up to Jefferson City and make this fight. You know, it just seems like everyone is afraid to come out as Well, and you noted this earlier. I mean, what we need, if you want to go after the unions, then put on your armor and pick up your spear and, by God, go after the unions. Don't come out with some mamby-pamby thing that you can claim isn't an anti-union bill. Now,
well, they're afraid to say they're anti-union when they are.
Yeah.
They're trying to have their cake and eat it, too, and not lose a few union votes in their town.
You need not be anti-union. I'm not anti-union. Unions have a place. I like people being allowed to join unions. I like the idea of collective bargaining. But I am anti the law protecting the unions, you know. If my meat cutters go on strike, by God, I'll fire them and hire some more. Well, if as long as it's not against the law to do so, you know, and it would be.
You'll pull a Ronald Reagan on them.
Yeah, well, you can't do that in a private business. I mean, if you're in a private business and you're a closed shop because some union contract that you signed forces you to hire only union people, then you are forbidden by law from firing them for going on strike.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the craziest thing I ever heard. So go after those legal protections of the union. Go after those legal, you know, go after the idea that a union can force its way in my front door and use my employees on the clock time to try to sell the union to them. You know, go after those kinds of crazy laws. And quite frankly, if we write right to work the way it should be written, and that is simply no employer can be forced by law or by contract to consider union membership or lack of thereof in the employment decision. What you're going to find is that basically is a nullification law. It nullifies the Wagner Act and Taft only. And so you're going to get in a fight with the courts. You're going to and that's another thing they're trying to avoid with this mamby-pamby wording of this thing they call right to work.
Mm-hmm.
But don't be afraid of those things. Don't be afraid of calling it a nullification law. Don't be afraid of taking on Taft, Hartley, and Wagner. Don't be afraid of speaking up for property rights, for the rights of the employer, over both the law. And of the union, and you know, put on your gear and get out on the battlefield and take the fight out there. Do it right.
Too many of our elected representatives, even those I might call good ones, are thinking too much about the next election and getting reelected.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And, well, that's definitely a problem. And, you know, I've often said that what we need are reps who will go in there kamikaze, who will simply concentrate on the term they're elected for and not worry at all about being reelected. And if they go in and do a good job without worrying about it, they're actually more likely to be honestly reelected by the people who approve of what they've done. But, you know, I've seen that locally with a candidate for state rep who had handlers come in paid by his party's legislative committee in Jeff City who managed his total campaign. And that particular rep had seemed to have a personality change after being coached by the handlers from Jeff City.
Right.
You know, still a good guy, but you know, he was more careful of what he said. He started to sound more like a politician. I had a talk with that particular rep, and I told him he was a good guy, and I'd support him now, but as soon as I thought he was turning into a politician, I would suggest that he simply resign. Got a funny look from him. I don't think anybody'd said something like that to him before. But, you know, that's a problem that we have with a lot of them. And one thing I like about Mike Moon is he doesn't seem to worry about the election. You know, but his reward was having people in his own party attack him in the primary.
And,
you know, because he was looking out for the people.
Exactly. Steve in the chat room says he's left a message on the line. Steve, give me a quick clue about what on the line means. Where is the question? And we'll certainly get to it, or feel free to call in 347-677-1835. It is Free Speech Saturday. So if you have a question about any topic, listeners, call in, a question, comment, discussion, topic, call in 347-677-1835. You called 347-677-1835 and it took you to a voicemail? That should have rung straight through. Give it another try, Steve. That should have rung straight through the studio number. 347-677-1835.
You know, speaking of our reps in the legislature and our senators, I have friends who are of varied schools of thought. Some simply no longer trust our system at all. They question even whether or not the votes that are being counted accurately. Bob Parker received, I think, fewer votes in the last primary than he did the previous one, but obviously had much, much more grassroots support. And there were comments made by Joanne Emerson's people that lead some people to believe there was finagling in that election. You know, in Ohio, outside of the state, we had one county that voted 110% for Barack Obama, not a single vote cast for Mitt Romney, which, you know, makes you wonder. There are others who think that the two-party system is simply totally lost, that both parties are corrupt. And I personally believe the two-party system is not good for America. I know the founders did not want it. It came about by accident. And a lot of those folks joined the Libertarian Party or the Constitution Party if they're liberty-minded, or the Green Party if they're very environmentally minded. And we've always had some that were in various other third parties out there. There are others who are trying to work within their party. The Missouri Precinct Project, for instance, thinks the Republican Party can be salvaged. And they are trying very hard to get people on the committees who are liberty-minded to salvage that party.
And while I disagree with them, I have a great amount of respect for all my Republican friends who are out to, quote-unquote, save their party. They're working very hard at it. I don't believe it can be done, but I am not one to get in the way of that. I appreciate the work they're doing, and I stand by to help them with anything that I can help them with as a person who's not a Republican. We have Steve. Steve's called in from New York, and he has a question about homeschooling, Mike. Go ahead, Steve.
Certainly. Hey, guys. I'm just wondering how you think Common Core is going to affect homeschooling, and do you think that within a few years that parents are even going to be able to continue homeschooling?
Excellent question, and I don't have children of school age, but I do have friends who homeschool. In fact, Kevin Jotz was on with us last night. He has 5 daughters, and they homeschool them all. And I think, Dave, you know Brett Adams, who has 11 kids, and they homeschool them. Brett and Kevin one time were joking around and said they're trying to outbreed the left-wing liberals. And by having so many. But, okay, the fear that I understand the homeschoolers have is that Common Core will affect the public schools and the entrance exams for colleges. The entrance exams will be based on Common Core questions. So you could have someone finish with homeschooling, get their, and then go in to take their GED test or their college entrance exams, and have a fantastic education. When it comes to history, for instance, no American history, front, back, right, and left, but not know the, you know, the gender studies and the feel-good crap that is being included now instead of, you know, 1776, the Declaration of Independence, when the Civil War was and why it was fought, World Wars I and II, when they were and why they were fought, etc. You know, the important meat that we all got in school is being left out. So they might not be able to get into a decent college.
Well, and not only is it, it's not only not always not only being left out, Mike, but it's frequently being taught wrong. I mean, so that you would actually get a wrong answer on a test. I read a Common Core test that was posted online. It was clearly copyrighted by this company that is writing the Common Core material, and that test had a question on it that said, what does the Second Amendment say? And the correct answer, of course, was that Americans are free to carry firearms within reasonable restrictions by the federal government. Well, no, that's not what the Second Amendment says. That's not what a homeschooled student understands the Second Amendment says. And so that is, in fact, the wrong question, although for the test, that's the question you need to, that's the answer you need to give to pass or to get into college.
Exactly, when the proper answer should have been a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Very different from the answer they want.
Right, exactly.
Very different. Some night, we should have Dr. Mary Byrne on
to talk about
Common Core.
Yes, I met Mary.
She is an expert.
I was not. She, I understand, was at PNP last weekend. I was not there when she was. I did talk to a representative of hers at that table, but I met Mary at a Mike Moon rally. She spoke at a Mike Moon rally. Mike Moon, of course, introduced anti-Common Core legislation in this year's this past session. I believe intends to introduce it again. But, yeah, we should definitely get Mary on some night, Dr. Mary.
Mm-hmm. There are other people out in the state who are speaking a lot and know a lot about it. But
she really impressed
me with her knowledge.
On this very show, and when I say this very show, I'm not talking about you and me on Friday and Saturday nights in State Sovereignty, but on Missouri Grassroots Radio, the show that airs nightly at 7 o'clock, on Tuesday nights, Lisa Payne Nager, I'm sorry, Lisa's on Wednesday nights. Lisa Payne Nager is on. She is the culture vigilante. She is a champion in the state of Missouri for homeschooling. She homeschooled both of her children, who are successfully planted in college now. She is huge on anti-Common Core. She frequently has Gretchen Logue on, who spends a great deal of time in Jefferson City day to day in the trenches fighting Common Core. They both are very well versed on how dangerous Common Core is. And going back to exactly what Steve was talking about or was asking about, with or without Common Core, I believe that that it is going to be a push by the legislatures in several states to not allow homeschooling in the future. But Common Core is a direct threat to homeschooling. It certainly is. I would suggest that there's going to be legislative moves in the next 2 years even to not outlaw homeschooling immediately, but to insist that if you homeschool, you follow this curriculum. Which simply means, why bother? Why bother homeschooling if all I can teach my kid and to get a high school diploma out of it is the crap that they're teaching them in the public school anyway? But Lisa's on Wednesdays, and she is the expert in Common Core. She has Gretchen on, and Gretchen knows a lot about it. She's up there in Jefferson City fighting it, and Mary, yeah, we'll get Dr. Mary on here some night, and we'll talk more about Common Core. And she's been on Lisa's show. And then on Tuesday, Cynthia Davis, although she doesn't spend a whole lot of time talking about Common Core and homeschooling, she does spend some. She's very learned in it. She did homeschool all her children. So, you know, the stuff is out there, but in specific answer to Steve's question, yeah, you're absolutely right, Mike. The biggest threat that the homeschooling parent has from the Common Core at this time, and that's something that we're not going to be able to completely control in our state legislature. I mean, we could pass all the Common Core we want. We can say over and over and over again that Missouri schools are not bound by Common Core, that Missouri school districts don't have to follow Common Core, that Missouri refuses to accept Common Core. But that's not going to change the fact that if you homeschool or if you are in a school district that sets its own standards and adopts its own curricula makes its own tests, that you're not putting yourself and your students at a huge disadvantage when it comes to statewide mandatory testing, statewide standardized testing, and more importantly, entrance exams. Because you are. I mean, you're definitely risking it. You've got to. I mean, if it's on a college entrance exam, that the only thing Thomas Jefferson did was own slaves, then you're sending your kid out of a homeschool handicap. Now the fact of the matter is that only the public universities have to use those standardized entrance exams. You're going to still have a lot of good universities, especially good conservative universities. Liberty U comes to mind right away, where they won't accept.
In Springfield, I could see Evangel and Drury,
right,
telling Common Core to take a hike.
Right. Yeah,
but MSU would have to follow.
But. The problem that these schools are going to have to have, MSU can never follow. MSU can never follow because they're a state-funded school and they'll be banned by Common Core. The problem you're going to have is like and your entrance exams is just that. I mean, you're going to be entrance exams, and that is the basic measure of whether is qualified to enter. So now that we develop our exam, I just there's no good.
Dave, I think we're having a technical difficulty. Can you tell on your end?
What difficulty are you having?
You sound better now, but seem to be kind of fading in and out. Could have been on my side.
I don't know.
You sound fine now. I think it went away.
Oh, okay. Well, I was actually... Yeah, I was taking a sip of tea there for a moment, so maybe I moved the microphone too.
It was Lipton. We're going to blame it on Lipton.
We're going to blame it on Lipton. Probably just move the microphone from my mouth and forgot to put it back. But
I had a cat named Lipton once because he was the color of a cup of tea.
Ah, okay.
Anyway, well, I think you're right. We need to get Mary on, and we need to listen to Lisa a little more on Wednesdays.
Right.
I know a lot of folks are very, very concerned about Common Core. I listened to a talk a couple of weeks ago by a teacher in a high school who was very concerned. He was showing us some of the new textbooks, and they are atrocious.
Yeah. They are.
And that's just history. Saw a presentation a few months ago on Common Core, and they were showing some of the literature required. And I'm not your average prude, but they had some things in some of the literature that was required reading for 15, 16-year-olds that I don't believe most parents would approve of. And I would rather not see a 15-year-old, you know, exposed in school to some of that. It was bordering things that might be X-rated. And
Yeah.
So.
That's, although.
And, you know, of course, that would make a lot of the high school kids simply want to read it, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm not. I remember when I was in school, we had some schools that were trying to ban Huckleberry Finn.
Sure.
But then the solution now is they're rewriting Twain. They're removing the offensive words that were very common at his
right.
time.
Yeah.
And, you know, remember Mark Twain was opposed to slavery, and one of the things Huckleberry Finn did was show the evils of slavery.
Right.
But because the, and I hate to say this, the quote, N-word was used.
Oh, yeah.
They're reissuing Huckleberry Finn with that word removed. And that's messing with classic literature. That's just wrong. And, almost reminds me of Orwell. So. Anyway, and the generation before mine had the problem with The Catcher in the Rye. They kept trying to ban it.
Exactly.
I read the book in high school, and I wondered what the big deal was. I thought it was pretty good. So.
Am I still breaking up? Listener
no,
tells
you sound
me that
fine
I'm,
now.
Okay, okay. Yeah, I agree. And like you say, I mean, don't think for 1 minute that... every 15-year-old who can get his hands on it hasn't read The Catcher in the Rye, that every 15-year-old who can possibly get his hands on it hasn't read Playboy magazine or Call Me Madam. But whether we want to make that part of the school curriculum where we stand up in front of the class and dissect it, discuss it, analyze it, and have a go at it, then, you know, that's two different things.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Definitely. And I haven't even looked at math, but I understand that the process is important now, not the solution that you get.
Yeah.
So
three plus
three doesn't have to be six.
That's been coming on for a good number of years. When I was teaching, there was a big push toward, the process, you know, did he do all the work? Maybe he or she didn't arrive at the right answer, but did they understand the concept involved in the problem? And I would never ever create a paper like that. I don't even need to see your work, quite frankly. You give me the right answer so that I know that when you build a catwalk in a hotel in downtown Kansas City that needs to be 42 feet long, that it is 42 feet long and not 39 feet 11 inches long, and I'm happy with that. I don't care what process you use to get there, but...
Yeah.
If you get the right number of feet from one wall to the next with that catwalk, process can send people plunging into the Potomac River.
That's true. That started years ago.
It did.
I was in grade school in the 60s, and I remember I was pretty good at doing math in my head,
mm-hmm.
and I would get in trouble with the teacher because I wouldn't show all of my work on division problems or multiplication.
Right.
I could look at it and just write down the answer. And that was bad back then.
Well,
that's when they called it, quote, the new math, unquote.
Yeah. But there's, you know, there. I don't want to say that all I want to do is look and see the answer. I didn't want to say that. I did say that. But I didn't want to. I mean, process is important. You know, because math is such a building thing, you know, you want to be able to look at someone's work in Algebra 1 and see that they need to do multiplication and division before they did addition and subtraction, and see that they need to to do the work inside parentheses before they added all the stuff outside the parentheses, because when the problem is 6 pages long and the answer is 14 pages long, then those processes are important, and you want to make sure that the student is grasping that process. The process is important, but it isn't the final answer.
But you know, this deterioration in American education isn't just, you know, history and civics. How many times have you gone to a fast food restaurant and let's say the order was $3.32 and you gave them a $5 bill and 32 cents and
yeah.
The clerk seemed confused.
Exactly.
They didn't know how to handle it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And, or wanted to take it back in and then still count out change to you.
Yeah. Or can't. I mean, it's even embarrassing the number of people running cash registers today who can't count back change. If the cash register doesn't tell them how much money to give you back, they can't figure it out.
No.
It's amazing. I was managing a convenience store here in Springfield, right across the street from Studi Middle School. So we're talking about an eighth-grade student. An eighth-grade student comes into my store almost every day and says, "What time is it, Mr. Court?" And I said, "There's a clock right on the wall." "Oh, I can't tell by that kind of clock. You know, a clock with hands on it. I can't do that kind of clock." Just amazing. And I'm not, you know, okay, so the world is changing. The world is changing, and we're getting away from clocks with hands on them, and we're getting to digital clocks. But we're not, and there's going to be a day when children are born who will never see a clock with hands on them in their life. And that's okay. But right now, we still live in a world full of clocks that have hands on them, and there's no excuse for not being able to look at that clock and know what time it is.
No, you do remind me of one of my favorite military jokes. When the Joint Chiefs of Staff broke for lunch, and the general said, "Gentlemen, we'll resume at 1400 hours. Or for those in the Navy, that's 2 bells.
Yeah.
For those in the Air Force, that's 2 p.m. And for those in the Marine Corps, that's when the mouse's little hand is over here." All proper respect to my Marine brothers. It's just the Marines are fun to tease.
They are. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back. We're going to tie up some admin ends, and then we're going to wrap this thing up for tonight. We'll be right back.
Hey, free market capitalist Missouri business owners, show Missouri and the rest of the country what hardworking, successful entrepreneurship looks like by advertising your business on Missouri Grassroots Radio. Get your message out to liberty-loving citizens who want to support liberty-loving capitalists. Target this unique and widespread market with your business's unique and valuable products and services. Contact us at info@MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org for details.
Yours, baby, I'll get mine. Don't
All right, we're back. It's the Saturday night version of the State Sovereignty Show. I'm Dave. That guy over there is Mike Slack. We're brought to you by Missouri Grassroots Coalition on Missouri Grassroots Radio. Mike and I will be back next Friday and Saturday night with the State Sovereignty Show. Lisa Payne Nager comes along on Wednesday nights with the Culture Vigilante. On Tuesday nights, our friend Cynthia Davis from the Constitution Party comes along. The little show she calls Homefront. You'll want to catch both of those. They're both rooted in constitutional politics and good moral character living. People being responsible for themselves. You know, that is really what liberty is all about. Everyone responsible for their own actions. Without personal responsibility, there can never be liberty. It just really is what it boils down to. Mike, what's your favorite rant for the night?
My favorite rant?
Yeah.
I'll go ahead and give a quick one on how texting is destroying the ability to spell. And it actually started with chat rooms and instant messages a few years ago. I'm a writer, and I work on editing other people's material. You would be amazed at the number of people with MBAs, PhDs, bachelor's degrees, who cannot spell. And they depend on the computer spell check, forgetting that there are many words in the English language that are very, very similar. For instance, we have two is T-O, T-O-O, and T-W-O, and they all mean very different things. And a great many folks out there, because our education standards are deteriorating, don't know the difference. They write two as an also, and they'll write T-O, leaving out that second O. Or T-H-E-Y. Apostrophe R-E, T-H-E-I-R, and T-H-E-R-E. They all mean different things. They all sound the same. I have proposed only half facetiously that we cut off the left hand immediately for the first infraction and the right for the second. I'd really like to see people learn how to spell and use proper grammar.
Is the implication of that people can spell better with their type when typing with their noses than with their fingers?
A lot of folks can, and it's businesses too. I saw a sign in West Plains today for a boot store, and it said over 6,000 pairs, P-A-I-R-S. Okay, the plural of pair is pair. There is no S.
Right.
And I saw another sign near Alton the other day for a well drilling company that misspelled the word licensed in their own sign advertising their business. even the Harry Truman Museum, okay? Harry Truman's name was Harry S. Truman. It was not a middle initial, it was just an S. Both of his grandfathers had names that started with S, so his parents just put an S there to make both grandparents think that Harry was named after them. But there is no period, because it's not an initial. Harry S., no period, Truman. And the Harry Truman Museum has it both ways in signs all over the place, sometimes with an S, sometimes not. So, okay, there's my rant.
Wow.
I'd also like to give a plug for LibertyBillboard.com. John Weber, near St. Louis, intends that to be a free billboard that all liberty-loving groups can use. I know the Constitution Party has started to post a lot of their activities on it, Oath Keepers, several other groups. And it covers the whole state. So libertybillboard.com. We need to start listing our shows on it, actually. And let's see. If anyone is in the area of Thayer on Labor Day, at Fred's Fish House in Mammoth Springs at 6 o'clock, we'll be having a meeting of our Common Sense Property Rights Coalition. And everyone is welcome. It's free to attend. And if you eat at the restaurant, they have great catfish, walleye, hush puppies. Our speaker will be the Emergency Management Director for Oregon County, who's going to tell us what their emergency management plans are. And I understand every county has an Emergency Management Director.
Right.
And if you belong to a patriot group out there or a political group or a social group, I'd say invite them out to speak and let people know exactly what their plans are. and most cities also have one too. So
they just had in Springfield, they just recently had an exercise that that was a test of their emergency response, and it lasted for quite a while because when they and I was impressed. It was just a building scenario, and they basically said we're going to keep piling stuff on till we fail. And thereby test the limits and know where we need to stretch the envelope.
That's a good idea.
I thought that was excellent. So you take failure as a friend rather than as an enemy, and just keep pushing and pushing and pushing until you do fail, and at that point you know where to start working.
That's good. You know, another thing I've been meaning to mention while we have time, and I'll give credit here to Doreen Hannes, who came up with this basic idea a while back, something called the 10-minute patriot. If everyone out there listening could set aside 10 minutes out of their day in the morning and do something to make their voices heard, whether it's making a phone call to their senator or their representative, or even to the governor, if you're unhappy with his malicious or vigorous prosecution statement, call his office or send emails. You know, we saw during the Blue Way episode what all of us banding together can accomplish. You know, we actually stopped the federal government from doing something we thought was bad. And if everybody out there would just give 10 minutes a day, they could really go a long ways towards maybe stopping Common Core, or at least getting it looked at more closely. Or, you know, if you know somebody who might be good in a particular political office, invite them, you know, to run. Suggest that they think about it. Ran across a fellow in the grocery store today that I think would be really good as county commissioner in my area. Suggested it to him. I hope he's going to take it seriously. You know, that's one of the reasons the MOP project is around, too, to help find good people to run for office.
Absolutely.
And we can all do that individually.
Yep. And I want to say this. I want to send this shout-out to Liberty Groups out in the state of Missouri. And this has been a mantra of Missouri Grassroots Coalition since we started. One of the basic one of the basic advantages of banding together as a group of groups, as a lot of groups that have a common goal, is that you bring a lot more power to Jefferson City. So that if we could get groups together from Springfield and the southwest part of the state, with groups from Cape Girardeau and the southeast part of the state, with groups from St. Louis and the northwest part of the state, and groups from Columbia and the north central part of the state, and groups from Kansas City in the northwest part of the state, we get all those groups together in one cause, and we go to Jefferson City and we march up the steps of the Capitol arm in arm, then we carry a lot more power than any one of us does or any one group does individually. But and I say this because of our tenet, our belief, our firm conviction that if we're going to take this country over, we start at the most basic unit. Here is the real power of a coalition of groups. It is not in Jefferson City even. It is in Springfield. It is in Cape Girardeau. It is in Hollister when they try to impose a curfew. It is in Kansas City. It is in Springfield when they try to impose a smoking ban. It is in West Plains when they try to institute red light cameras. And that is the ability to bring that same number of people from all over the state to bear on a local issue, on an issue that is anti-liberty, on an issue that is anti-American, I will even say, in a local area, and say, listen, we are the people of the sovereign state of Missouri, and we're watching you down there. We know what you're doing, and we will bring to bear all of the power of this group from all over the state on you, city councilman, on you, Mr. Mayor, on you, Mr. Prosecuting Attorney. That is the power of a coalition of groups.
Mm-hmm. Very true.
So I'm done for the night. I want to remind everyone that Cynthia is here on Tuesdays, that Lisa is here on Wednesdays. Do not miss those shows. I'm working hard with a group now to get a night of free grassroots radio dedicated to education and information on Agenda 21, an ongoing weekly program about Agenda 21. And we'll let you know when that comes about. It won't be long. But meanwhile, stay tuned for Cynthia, stay tuned for Lisa, and join Mike and I back here again next week when we present the State Sovereignty Show. Mike Moon will be joining us on Friday. We'll be talking about the veto session and Mike's current campaign, current Jefferson City, represent us. Mike's a good guy, and if you want to be behind him, I certainly want to discuss the veto session with him, because he is of a liberty mind. And Mike, got any parting words?
I'm all done. Let's wrap
all
it
right.
up.
Here we go, folks. Until next week, this is Dave. That is Mike. And good night. Thanks for tuning in.
There are so many contradictions. All these messages we send, keep asking, how do I get out of here? Where do I fit in? Though the world is torn and shaken,